Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Author Chris Guillebeau has made a name for himself encouraging people to think differently. Or as he would put it, he encourages the art of nonconformity. It's also the name of his first book and his blog. His second book was a New York Times bestseller. The $100 Startup chronicled the real-life efforts of small-scale entrepreneurs to start businesses on a shoestring, countering the idea that you need to get a loan or spend a bundle to start a new business. Guillebeau is also an avid traveler. He's completed a personal quest to visit every country on the globe. And quests are the subject of his latest book, The Happiness of Pursuit. In it, he sought out people who have or are on personal missions. These are more than mere goals, and from the outside, they often seem outrageously unachievable or even outlandish. Guillebeau spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about why he chose the topic.
This book is the story of a quest. It's the story of adventure. And it draws on my journey to every country in the world, but not just my journey, thankfully. I used the case study model to look at all kinds of other people around the world who had also pursued a quest.
I find it interesting that you do reference very old texts and very old quests in the book, Homer, for example. Mm-hmm. Anything different these days about it? I mean, is it different that we're in a very affluent Western country, and do we do quests now because we're bored, or do is it still that same drive, do you think, that people have?
I think there are a lot of things that are similar and a lot of things that are different. So some of the things that are similar, a quest has this end goal. It has this challenge, you know, that the hero must, you know, kind of endure or go through. There are all these different stages along the way. There's lots of opportunities to become sidetracked. There are actors that help or hinder that person along the way. So some of those things are kind of constant from the stories of old to modern day quests. I guess why I was interested in modern-day quests is most of those stories of old, they're not true. You know, they're just fiction. They're mythology. And it doesn't mean they lack value. They can entertain us, maybe inspire us. But I was interested in you know, real-life quests. Why do people do this? Is it a product of being bored? I don't know. I think the human condition is drawn towards striving. I think we want to strive towards something, especially when we have a good life. We have lots of opportunities. Why not build something? Why not work towards something?
It just seems like our country at the moment anyway, and maybe I'm just being negative, but seems like there's a lot of malaise or defeatedness mindsets, and people may not be as willing to try things. So it's interesting to read real stories about people that are doing things big and small that are considered quests.
Yeah, well, malaise is an interesting word. I use the word discontent in the book. And what I found was a lot of people are drawn toward quests or adventures out of a sense of discontent. And it doesn't mean that they're miserable necessarily, but it does mean that they're kind of longing for something more. And maybe they are a little bit unsettled. Maybe they are dissatisfied in some way. And maybe they've had this idea. A lot of people described it as a crazy idea that I had in my head. It wouldn't leave me alone. And so as they responded to the discontent, they combined it with something specific. That's how they kind of found this purpose. That's how they found this meaning as they worked toward the quest.
How does one decide that something that's nagging at them is worth becoming a pursuit or a quest as opposed to just kind of an emotional tick or just something that is fine just to think about?
Well, you know, I think when I say like they have this crazy idea, it's not so much that it's nagging at them. It's something that they're excited by. And maybe they're also a little bit afraid of it too. And it's just this big thing they can't get away from. And, you know, in my case, I didn't start from country number one or number two and then said, I'm going to go to all 193 countries in the world. I just loved to travel. And as I pursued travel, I lived in West Africa for 4 years, went to a bunch of countries. I also loved making lists. I was always writing things down. So I started writing down lists of all my countries. And that's when I set the goal of going to 100 countries. And as I got closer to that goal, I set the goal of going to every country. So it's something that kind of developed over time. I don't think you always have this huge vision. But I do think, you know, as you pursue hobbies or passions or different things that you're drawn to, I do think, you know, having some structure helps, having those parameters helped. Once I had the goal of like going to every country and working them down on my list, it just kind of gave me so much more interest in the whole experience.
And as a follow-up then, what elevates a pursuit into a quest? You gave some examples of what would not be a quest, like one's desire to lose weight, for example,
sure.
or to to buy a new car, for example, are not quests. Those
right.
are goals.
Perhaps. Yeah, there are all kinds of things we do to improve our lives, and hopefully we're all trying to improve our lives over time. But I think a quest is something different. I think a quest is something bigger. It doesn't necessarily have to be grandiose. It doesn't have to be huge. I mean, there are a lot of stories in the book of people doing like truly big things. There was a guy who ran 250 marathons in a single year. That's pretty huge, right? But most of us, including myself, can't really relate to that. I think, you know, something goes from the hobby or pursuit to a quest once it acquires some scope and structure. So if you like to play golf, for example, you know, like to play golf, that's your hobby. You start getting more serious about it. Maybe you're taking some lessons. Maybe you're traveling a little bit to play different courses. You know, then it's becoming a passion. But then if you decide, I want to play every course in Scotland, you know, or the top 100 courses in the United States or something like that. I think that's when it becomes a quest. That's when you can point to an end goal for it.
Do you think that this is for everyone? Do you think everyone should have some kind of quest in their life, whether it be big or small? Or, you know, in other words, is it okay just to live day to day without having this quest in your life?
If you're happy, it's okay to be happy. That's fine. But let me say that, you know, what I'm trying to accomplish, like I'm not necessarily saying every person should have a quest. A quest helped me. A quest helped a lot of different people that I talked to. But what I want to encourage people to do is to cultivate the value of adventure in their lives, whatever that looks like. You know, I want to encourage people to pursue big things, to build something, to work towards something, to strive, you know, as we said. And that takes on different forms for different people. So I talked to lots of folks who didn't want to travel necessarily or weren't able to visit every country in the world. Or there was another guy who took a vow of silence for 17 years. You know, once again, like amazing story, I don't want to do that. You know, and that's okay. But I do think everyone can embrace adventure in different ways, and I think their life will be better for it if they do.
You know, as I read through the book, I couldn't help put on the psychologist's or what I think would be a psychologist's mind or go into their mindset. And they might just say, wow, some of these people might be obsessed with what they're doing. Do you think that is part of it? And
obsession is a tricky
yeah.
word, you know,
yeah,
because, you know, it seems to carry this negative connotation. You know, I don't think I was obsessed, you know, with my 10-year journey to every country. It certainly guided a lot of my life. It guided a lot of the decisions I made. And I would go away at the end of the year and I would kind of plan out everything I'm doing over the next year and lots of different projects and different things I was working on and family goals. But then I had this anchor. You know, I had this thing like, okay, in addition to all of that, I have to go to 18 countries next year or whatever that was. And that structure helped me. So I'm sure there could be a negative side, you know, if it becomes all consuming. Or maybe the negative side is when you actually don't enjoy it. But you feel like you have to because you said this thing or something. But in my case, it was very positive. In my case, like, you know, it brought purpose to my life because I knew exactly what to do next. And I liked that.
Yeah, I'm just remembering one anecdote in the book about a father and husband who, a photographer, I believe, and he may have let it get a little bit too far, perhaps, he just said his relationship with his kids and his wife were starting to become affected by his pursuit of his passion.
I think he became mindful of that, and I think that's good. I think you can lose sight of what matters to you regardless of whether you have a quest or an adventure. You know, a lot of people kind of get sucked into their work too much or they just become distracted. And so in his case, yeah, he loved this thing so much that it was affecting some of his relationships. And so he had to have a little bit of a rebalancing. And we did see that, you know, with a lot of people who are kind of pursuing something like full-fledged, totally into it. They didn't always live the most balanced lives. But again, I guess most of them would say, you know, they lived a good life and they did things that matter. And they didn't necessarily have to sacrifice their relationships to do that.
Which of these, all the quests in the book, leap out at you as the kind of the role models of a quest?
I loved this story of Sasha Martin, who is a young mother in Oklahoma. And she had kind of settled down. First, she grew up in Europe in some different places, but then she settled down and her husband had a daughter. And she wasn't able to travel, but she wanted to raise her daughter with an international perspective. And so instead of visiting every country in the world, Sasha used her skills. She had a degree in culinary arts. She chose to make a meal from every country in the world. And she turned this into a quest. It wasn't just like, I'm going to make a bunch of foreign food. It was, you know, once a week, starting with Afghanistan, letter A, I'm going to go through, you know, every single country, all 193, and I'm going to make a meal, and I'm going to post recipes online, and we're going to play music from the country. And so her daughter, you know, beginning from when she's 6 months old, is growing up with this global awareness of all kinds of different cultures. And to me, that's a great, great story, because she didn't have to travel anywhere. She didn't have to sacrifice any relationships. In fact, it strengthened her relationships. But the quest is what made it possible. It wasn't just, you know, I'm going to experiment a little bit. It was like, here are the rules that I'm creating for myself, and here's how we're going to do it.
And that endeavor has taken her somewhere else at this point.
Yeah, right? Now she's created this whole global community, and she started posting these things online, and she has traveled some now.
One of the chapters in the book, or sections of the book, talks about discontent, mm-hmm. or serial discontent, or we could put it any number of ways. At what point do you think that becomes something that people need to look at? I mean, people can be unhappy with their jobs or relationships.
Sure.
So when does that parlay itself into the need for a quest?
Well, I think you can't just be unhappy. You have to do something about it, right? There's lots of unhappy people in the world who don't make any changes. But I guess I'm interested in looking and seeing, okay, when someone is unhappy, what are they unhappy about? What kind of change can they make? Is it a big change? Is it a small change? There was a woman who got laid off from General Motors after working there for 8 years. And you know, she was laid off along with a number of her colleagues. And all of her colleagues kind of went into panic mode, and they all started, you know, updating their resume and sending things out and doing everything they could, because they felt like this was the only time, you know, that they had to act fast. And she used this time as a moment of reset in her life. And she said, you know, I need another job. I get that. But before I do that, there is this thing that I've always wanted to do. And her thing was she wanted to travel on America's Route 66 and go through that whole iconic voyage and take photographs along the way and document it and camp. And she's really glad that she did. I mean, she pursued that journey. She actually ended up getting an all-new career as a result of this. She ended up writing a book and getting some things in magazines and then leading tours in her native Canada. But those kind of things were almost secondary. Like for her, it was, you know, she's discontented, but she's going to combine it with action, not just going to remain in that unhappiness.
Can you tell us a little bit about something in the book called rejection therapy? Because that was in one section, but throughout the book, I've noticed there are points which it's alluded to that people are just afraid to try new things because they're either afraid of rejection or afraid of change. So I thought that was an interesting way to put it, rejection therapy.
Yeah, great. That's a great story. Well, most of us are afraid of rejection and change, I think. And there was this young guy named Zha Jiang, a Chinese-American who's living in Texas. And Zha had applied for a job that he was super excited about. He felt that he did a really good job in the interview. And when they called to say, sorry, you didn't get the job, he found himself extremely disappointed. And not just a little bit disappointed, but he was crushed. And he was almost disappointed in his disappointment because he thought, this shouldn't matter so much to me. So he created an experiment for 100 days. So he had a 100-day quest where every single day he would go out and deliberately seek rejection. He would do these series of social experiments where he would go to a police officer and ask to drive his car. He would go into a fire station and ask to slide down the pole. He went to a restaurant and asked to cook his own food. He did all of these really funny things. And some of them they actually said yes to. And so it created a whole other dynamic. He went to Krispy Kreme and asked them to make a series of donuts in the shape of the Olympic rings, which was during the Olympics. And they actually did it. And he recorded this and it became this YouTube sensation with millions of views. But the whole experiment was to become comfortable with rejection, to become comfortable with the idea that we don't always get what we want. But, you know, if we want something, we should work toward it and we should be prepared for whatever the possibility is.
You spend some time talking about your year-end review. So you do this every December.
I do.
Take stock of the year and see what went right and went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still do that?
I do. I started this about 6 or 7 years ago, and it's probably been the number one thing that's helped me the most in terms of a career of writing books and having a blog and producing events and all the different things that I do. I spend a few days just kind of looking back on the previous year, and I ask myself, like, what went well? I write down a few things, what did not go well, what were my disappointments? And then I spend another couple of days identifying goals, you know, for different categories in my life. What do I hope to achieve, you know, as a writer, as an entrepreneur, in my personal life, in my health, finances, all these different areas. And then I kind of, you know, schedule a lot of my next year around these goals. And there's a whole template for this, which is free on my website if anyone wants it. And it's probably helped, as I said, more than anything else, because that structure, which again comes from me, it's not something that's imposed. You know, if you do this exercise, it's your own structure. Then you know exactly what to do to achieve what you want.
Well, so at this point, you have been to every country in the world, yes?
Yes.
After that, I mean, what can you possibly do?
I know it's tough, you know. Yeah. Like, I wanted to go to the moon, but it's hard to do that. I was at the book event the other night, and someone said, you should go back to every country in reverse order. And I said, that sounds great for you. Like, no, thank you. Like, I had a great experience. But I'm still traveling. I'm still writing. For me, the biggest change that happened in the journey is that I was always very introverted. I was just an independent traveler doing my own thing, and I'm still an introvert. But this great, wonderful community kind of came alongside, and now there's all kinds of other people who are traveling and starting businesses or starting nonprofits, or they're artists or students, just doing really fun stuff. And so I think whatever I do next is going to be much more focused on that community, on whatever I can do to support them.
Now, the pace at which you went to all these countries, I mean, did you get to really get a feel for countries, or sometimes was it just you want to drop in and come out? I would imagine there's a few places where one doesn't want to stay.
Yes.
For very long.
Yeah, so there are a few. But there are, you know, those, I think those are relatively few, you know, considering 193 countries. I did this over 10 years, so it wasn't super quick. I lived in Sierra Leone for a year, in Liberia for a year. I lived in the Philippines for 2 years, other places where I would spend a week or more. But it's also fair to say there were some places I went for just a relatively short period of time, a couple of days or something. And it was never my goal to, you know, to be an expert on every country in the world. Like, I would never say that. But I think I had a pretty authentic experience overall.
After seeing every country in the world, where do you want to go back to?
I made a short list. You know, I made a list of all these places that I liked and wanted to go back. And it's funny because, you know, the criticism often was, well, you're not spending a lot of time there. And I always thought, well, if I like somewhere, I can go back, right? So now I'm spending more time in Australia, a country I really loved. I'm going to go back to Lithuania, just a small country in Eastern Europe that I really had a great time in. I'm going to go back to South Africa and spend time there. Laos and Bhutan in Southeast Asia. So I'm still traveling.
Well, Chris Guillebeau, thank you very much for coming on Leg Effect.
Thank you, Dan.
Chris Guillebeau is the author of The Art of Nonconformity, The $100 Startup, and his latest, The Happiness of Pursuit. He spoke with Dan Harmon. And I'm Bonnie North, thanking you as always for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.